This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up later on the show today, we learn about a doctor from Grand Forks who gets a prestigious fellowship because of her work on the science of aging. And we are going to start with another doctor, Dr. Allie Swabany. She is with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. And Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we need to set it up with what is a naturopathic doctor and how is that different from what other people might think of as maybe a Western or a general practitioner?
Yeah, so a naturopathic doctor is a doctor who diagnoses, prevents, and treats both acute and chronic illness, mostly by identifying the underlying cause of disease. And one of our primary goals is supporting the body's innate healing. You know, we're all oriented towards health naturally. So the idea of naturopathic medicine is supporting that to create optimal health.
So how is that different from a Western medical doctor?
Well, a lot of things are the same. Okay. Our training, for example, is very rigorous, as a medical doctor training is. So we're trained at an accredited naturopathic medical college, 4-year degree after an undergraduate degree. And so we pass board exams, we go through licensure, all of that. But we do have additional training in nutrition, diet, lifestyle examination, counseling, herbal medicine, homeopathy, physical medicine. We have a lot of tools in our belt.
Okay. Yeah, I was intrigued on a website that just was going through what is a naturopathic doctor. And one of the first items on the list is remove obstacles to health. What does that mean?
Yes. So the whole idea of naturopathic medicine is that, like I said, we're kind of naturally oriented towards health. You know, I kind of think of it like a sunflower naturally turns toward the sun. You know, we are oriented towards healing. And what obstructs our healing is really the problem. I think in this sort of conventional medical world, we have the idea that it's the bugs. You know, it's the disease that comes in and takes over, and that's the problem. And really, we all have different susceptibilities to disease. And so the idea is to get us to our optimal level of health and make our bodies really inhospitable to any bugs that might want to come in and cause a problem.
Okay. So fair to say that there is something of an innate ability to heal oneself. And so a doctor of naturopathy would be more inclined to allow the body to heal itself, treating the illness, not the symptoms?
Exactly. Treating the cause is a huge part of what we do.
Okay.
So we have like several principles that we work under, and treating the cause of illness is one of them. So that's one of the ways I think you could say we differ from medical doctors is the approach we take. So although there are medical doctors who use integrative therapies, a naturopathic doctor is really trained in identifying all of those underlying causes of a condition, trying to remove the causes there, and then through that optimizing health. So an example would be migraines. So conventionally, if you have chronic migraines, you're probably taking either over-the-counter or prescription pain medications, right? That's one of the major treatments in the conventional world for migraines.
Okay.
If a naturopathic doctor sees somebody with migraines, they're going to do a pretty broad assessment to determine what some of the underlying causes of those migraines are. It could be hormones, it could be diet, could be lifestyle factors, nutritional deficiencies. All those things can contribute to migraines. So we identify those things, we nourish the body in the way that we need to, and therefore generally get a lot of success with getting rid of the migraines. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And so what I'm hearing is a lot of, you know, it makes sense to me that when you say like a conventional doctor might look at something like a bacteria and then the exposure to that bacteria and then that leads to the disease, there's a straight line that you can draw between cause and effect. Mm-hmm. And a doctor of naturopathy would be more so inclined to say, here's how we can prevent that bacteria from becoming a problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good question. So
I bet there's about 800 answers.
There is. I mean, one of the things that we, I think, do well is individualizing plans for each person. You know, we treat the whole person, right? Mm. So I don't treat the migraine as much as I treat the person.
Okay.
So that person needs A, B, C, and D. So mm-hmm. we help their body get A, B, C, and D. And the next person might need E, F, G, and H. Do you see what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. different needs for different people. But I think, you know, earlier I said we have sort of an expansive tool belt. I think that's what kind of another thing that sets us apart from medical doctors and really makes us unique is the tools we use. So I mentioned herbal medicine. So we have all forms of various flowers and plants that we use in various ways to mm-hmm. help treat the conditions we see. We use homeopathy, which is a very sort of subtle but powerful form of medicine. And then all of that sort of foundational stuff, like let's drink more water, let's get some movement in, let's get sunshine,
mm-hmm.
time in nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you just mentioned a couple things that are really difficult to do in the winter in these prairie regions.
Yes.
Here when, okay, I want to go outside, but if this wind chill's negative 23 and the wind is, you know, 20 miles an hour, it's difficult. So what are some of the kinds of conditions that people in this region might be experiencing at higher levels than other parts of the country?
Yeah, so there's a few. You know, one of the things you hear about a lot and that I see a lot would be seasonal affective disorder, which varies in its severity. And you know, sometimes I'll even say to my patients, they'll come in saying, I have seasonal affective disorder. And I'll say, well, okay, let's see if it's actually a disorder. You know, we're affected by the seasons.
Mm.
But is it disordered? I don't know. It depends on the severity of it, I think.
Okay.
Certainly there are things we can do to improve the way people feel in the wintertime. A lot of those things we know, and part of what I do is just helping hold people accountable for, you know, well, yeah, we can't go outside and, you know, do your regular hike along the river, but why don't we just get on the treadmill? You know, why, you know, how can we work together to create a plan that's sustainable for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, vitamin D deficiency is huge in our region. That's a vitamin that you get from the sunshine, and it's not very accessible in the wintertime. So we do supplement that for people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do think in some cases it's more of a perspective change than anything else.
Yeah, well, those are tough. You mentioned too just exposure to nature.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that. What do you mean by exposure to nature and what kind of impact that can that have on, are you talking mental health, physical health, both?
Both. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to forget the name of it. So there's a person, there's an author that talks about nature deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been sort of an idea out there for decades now, but I see it to be a real thing, you know, especially the lives we live. We're in our cars, we're in our homes, we're moving. But we're not necessarily just getting out into nature and allowing the nervous system to reset in the way that it does when we're swimming in the lake or walking in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So something physically happens in our nervous system when we're in nature that's different than when we're just in our cars driving to work.
Right.
And so that does greatly impact. I'd say it's in most people that I see, at least a part of their plan is making sure they're getting out in nature and they're finding ways to reset their nervous system, even in the winter months. So say they can't get outside as much in the winter months. Well, okay, what other ways can we reset the nervous system? You know, does just sitting quietly in a nook in your house drinking tea help reset your nervous system, or does it look like something else for you? So in that way, we go back to that individualized piece where we kind of really find for you what helps to do that.
Sure. I'm sure there's no such thing as an average treatment plan for a patient, but I think it's safe to say that it might take a while. You might be seeing a patient for a little while as you're trying out these different things that aren't just a, this is a pill for said condition.
Yes. Yeah, it takes more time and more commitment on the part of the patient. So that's something that I talk with people about in their first or second visit is, you know, I ask, what is your level of motivation here? Is it zero to 10? Give me where you're at. And if you're not an 8, 9, or 10, then maybe it's not a good fit for you. You know, we want somebody in our practice who's going to be willing to do some work to get well. And if they're not, they're probably going to be wasting their time and money. And we always have the option to start slow, you know. So some people are just like, I really want this. I want to be well, but I need to take it slow. Great. Let's do that. Let's do one step at a time. You know, how many times can you go for a walk this week? Let's start there. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare, I think, that I actually get a patient in my door who doesn't say, like, I'm highly motivated, because they, by the time they get to our clinic, often they've been through a lot already in terms of their medical history. You know, they've often seen many, many practitioners and had many types of treatment and just don't feel great. And so I do tend to get a highly motivated patient walk in my door. And that's great, because that means then they're willing to kind of put the time and energy in. It does, I would say, depending on the condition, you know, take anywhere from 6 months to a couple years to really get where we need to go. And the other thing is that we're also looking for prevention, right? So I have a lot of people coming in who say, like, my mom has Alzheimer's. I really don't want that disease. What can I do? And so that is a longer term plan we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. We need to improve health in the immediate sense and then talk about what can you do in your life long term to prevent this disease.
Are there conditions that aren't a good fit for naturopathy?
I don't think so. I think we're pretty well equipped to treat all ages, all types of disease. There are limitations. Obviously, we don't treat, you know, acute trauma. Go to the ER.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No gunshot.
Yeah. I don't want a heart attack in my office. Like, go to the ER. Those things conventional medicine is amazing at, and I'm so grateful for it, that we have that ability, that resource. Mm-hmm. But outside of those acute things, we have a lot of tools to treat almost anything from cradle to grave. You know, we have a midwife in our practice. Her name's Molly Ferguson. She is a naturopathic doctor and a midwife, and she helps women give birth at home and then treats mom and baby for those first, you know, those early weeks. And then we see infants in the clinic all the way up. So it's really fun. It's fun to be able to see all stages of life and all different types of conditions. But I'd say probably our bread and butter is the chronic conditions that the conventional medical world sort of has some difficulty with, you know, like they go through the various medication options and the people just aren't really feeling good still. Those are the people that I think most often end up in our clinic.
So as a naturopathic doctor, how do you see your relationship with either Western medicine or maybe more specifically with a doctor of Western medicine? Do you work together? Do you have to be at odds?
No, not at all. I love that question, because I think that's the assumption, is that it's one against the other. And that is not how I feel about it at all. Part of the reason I went into this medicine was because I felt that there wasn't enough options and there wasn't enough interdialogue between the conventional medical world and all forms of alternative medicine. You know, in my own life, I had found help but from various things, from energetic medicine to massage to naturopathic medicine. Mm-hmm. And it felt like two separate worlds to me. So I felt like, well, there's got to be a way that these two things can work together. And I think in practice here in our region, I've seen that happening a lot. The relationship between naturopathic doctors and medical doctors, I'd say, varies depending on the doctor we're talking about. And I mm-hmm. think it has most to do with just education and awareness. You know, do they have a clear understanding of what we do? And if they have that understanding, then generally it tends to be a very respectful relationship mm-hmm. and some referrals going back and forth.
I have seen a little bit of an increase. I know Sanford has some people that they call integrative care specialists, mm-hmm. where one person even practices Reiki, which is, I have a limited understanding of this, but an energetic form of medicine. They mm-hmm. have sometimes yoga, and I've seen acupuncture. It's a very small percentage of the services provided, but has anybody ever reached out to you or, you know, people that you know of to work together within the hospital situation?
I'm not aware of that happening here in our community. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear they have those services. I knew there were some integrative doctors, but I didn't know about the Reiki and yoga, and I'm thinking like the spread the word, you know, just spread the word.
The more the merrier.
But I know in other parts of the country, naturopathic doctors do work in hospital settings, especially on the West Coast. That's where I got my training and lived many years. And, you know, it's fairly common to have a naturopathic doctor on staff. Mm. And the, you know, primary care doctors, you know, I wouldn't say there's just as many naturopaths as medical doctors, but the numbers are getting up there in Seattle, Portland, some of those West mm-hmm. Coast cities.
Okay. And here, not as much.
Not as much. We have six doctors in our clinic. There's at least a few practicing in the area as well beyond us. And as far as I know, that's it.
Pretty big, though, for a town the size of Moorhead and not serving a huge population. Obviously, you draw from more than just Moorhead.
Yes.
And that includes a recent expansion, though. So it sounds like business is good.
Yes. We've been rapidly expanding. I've been at the clinic for 6 years, and our clinic size has tripled in that time. And we've gone from 3 to 6 doctors just in the last year mm-hmm. and a half. So we're very excited to be able to get patients in quickly now, which is something that we were struggling with for a period because the demand was really high and we just didn't have enough doctors on staff. So now we do. And I think the array of services that we offer would really surprise most people. You know, I mean, we have a treatment area where we're doing, you know, dozens of treatments throughout mm-hmm. the week for people that are used for all kinds of different conditions, but some old naturopathic therapies, some new, you know, we call them physiotherapies that are kind of up and coming. And so there's a lot of options for treatment available in mm-hmm. Moorhead now.
Well, let's talk about some of the cost involved with this, because a lot of people who are seeking alternatives, insurance won't cover it, you know, unless, you know, maybe you get hit by a car and your car insurance will cover acupuncture, but your regular health insurance is not going to in a lot of cases. Are there payment plans for people who are looking for this type of health care, but their insurance isn't going to cover it?
Yes, we do. We have, we call them health service agreements that we offer to our patients that are, you know, basically it's a payment plan, a way in which they can kind of know the total cost of their plan or what we estimate that to be and be able to pay that in a way that's workable for their income. So we're happy to be able to offer that to people. Again, in other parts of the country, insurance does cover our care, mm-hmm. Just as it would any other physician. And so I'm hoping, you know, we're hoping for that to come to our region sometime in the near future. But as as it stands now, we'll offer those health service agreements for people who need them.
Okay. One of the first things that you mentioned, and we're talking with Dr. Ali Swabany with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead, and one of the first things that you talked about in terms of the toolkit that you use as a naturopathic doctor is nutrition.
Yeah.
How much of a difference does it really make what we're eating?
Oh.
That's an enormous question, isn't it? Or what are some of the kinds of conditions, I guess, is maybe the clearer question that might be attributed to the kind of food, the fast food, the sitting at the desk kind of eating that we do?
Yeah. So the obvious ones would be diabetes, hypertension, or high blood pressure. You know, these things are enormously affected by what we eat. But I think there's a lot of people don't understand quite how much effect what we eat is having on our immune system, our digestive system. I mean,
well, the CDC has recently said upwards of 70% of the chronic diseases that Americans face are based on your gut health.
Yes. Yes. And that's wonderful that that's finally being sort of recognized in the research. Naturopathic doctors have been saying the gut, as we say it, the gut, is central to health for since the beginning of our profession.
You call it a second brain.
Yes. Yeah. And now there's more and more research coming out supporting that. So that's it's amazing that, again, like the word is getting out about that. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is, of course, the bacteria in our digestive system and the benefits and problems they can cause depending on what type of bacteria you have and the population of them. So I think people would be surprised by the connection that what we eat has on our mental health as well. Mm-hmm. It's been astounding. I mean, I knew in theory going through school that that was a thing. But then you start to actually see it over and over in practice, how much better people feel mentally and emotionally when they're eating the foods appropriate to their body. And I think it's again, not a one size fits all. I mean, there's some basics that we go by. You know, you want to get vegetables in. That's important. You don't want to eat a whole lot of processed foods and sugars. But beyond that, there's so much individualizing that needs to be done. And now there's so much information out there on the internet, podcasts, wherever you go for your information on what kind of diet you should be eating. And the truth is that it depends on the person. And so that's where a professional can help to really guide you and what's best for your body.
Well, it sounds like we might need to have you on for several more segments. Dr. Ali Swabany is with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors. Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
And we should mention that in addition to where you practice, there is a Naturopathic Doctor Association in North Dakota that has practitioners in Fargo, Bismarck, Mandan, Minot, and Carrington. Now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. State Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring says he is hoping to see some rebound in his agency's budget for the next biennium.
We took a big hit. We lost, you know, over 15% of our general funding.
Goring says that meant some programs were run on fees and others needed to be restructured.
And we still fell short, so it's been challenging. No raises for the last 3 years. Morale was getting beat down a little bit, and then with the request that came in this summer in the governor's budget, which was looking at more cuts, and this time even going into special funds, it really had staff and people just in a quandary.
Goring says with lawmakers back in session, there is hope. He says a needs-based budget has been submitted, and despite some initial confusion about the budget his department submitted, Goring says he has hopes going forward.
Unlike a company where the CEO manages the budget, handles the budget, puts the budget together, and then appropriates, that doesn't work in government. The executive branch executes, and the legislative branch appropriates.
Goring says agriculture touches a lot of things in North Dakota and says lawmakers have connected the dots and understand its importance. In November, voters approved a state constitutional change to create a state ethics commission. Now a Fargo lawmaker has introduced a bill to implement it. Democratic Senator Tim Mathern's bill would take 4 years to fully implement. The bill creates the five-member commission now and then calls for an interim study to set out the rules on what government officials and lobbyists can and cannot do.
I believe any one of us is susceptible to doing things wrong, including me. The more I have clarity, the greater the likelihood that I actually will act in a positive manner and in the common good. That's the rationale for this.
Mathern says he has the backing of the group that proposed the initiated constitutional measure. And since December 20th, the Barnes County Jail is only able to keep inmates for a maximum of 4 days. Then they have to be transferred to other facilities. Why is it declared unsafe? Here's Barnes County Sheriff Randy McLaughlin.
Recreation in the basement, the outside recreation, and no direct supervision, no office space. The kitchen is obviously outdated. No secure control room. There's no watch cells off booking that we can visibly watch. Mm-hmm. It's unsafe for the inmates. It's unsafe for the staff. You know, the outdoor rec like that, it's really unsafe for everybody because anything could get thrown over that fence.
McLaughlin says there's been a lot of turnover with the jail staff.
Most of them went to other jobs. Like a couple of them went to John Deere and we hired one and got them trained and then they went back to their previous job because they got a pay raise. All three of them got more pay than what the county pays for a correctional officer. You have to have a licensed person there, so right now we're kind of short with that.
In 2018, the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation told Barnes County officials to have a plan in place to renovate or build a new jail. The jail committee members voted to build a new jail, but the committee has not been able to decide which architectural firm to hire or where the new jail should be built. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me in our Grand Forks studio is Dr. Holly Brown Borg. She is a Chester Frist Distinguished Professor of Biomedical Sciences at the University of North Dakota's School of Medicine and Health Sciences and has recently been named a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Dr. Brown Borg, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
What does it mean to you to receive this honor?
Well, it's recognition of the work that I've been doing and the a variety of different people that have helped me throughout the years in the biology of aging area.
And when we say something like the biology of aging, it sounds like we should know what that means. but maybe not all of us really do know. What is the biology of aging?
So there's a group of researchers, including myself, that are very interested in understanding why we age and how we age. And so we study various types of systems that are involved in both animal systems, invertebrates and vertebrates, and mammalian systems, and humans to try to understand the processes that are involved in aging and age-related disease.
And systems, you're talking like the endocrine.
The endocrine system.
Thank you.
The heart, the kidney, muscles. How all these different systems in your body contribute to aging processes.
And can you give us a summation? How do those contribute?
So in my own field, in the endocrine field, which is the study of hormones, so all the hormones that circulate in the bloodstream, we have found that different hormones contribute to biochemical processes, like a lot of those involved in metabolism and growth, and how those are involved in contributing to aging and how some people age slower, some people age faster, that type of thing. So in particular, we study a hormone called growth hormone. And I think most people are familiar with that particular hormone stimulates us to grow in height and weight as you age, mostly through as children and as adolescents.
And how do you study a growth hormone?
So this particular hormone is produced in your brain, in the pituitary gland in the brain, and it's secreted into the bloodstream, and the levels vary throughout life. And what we have found is that an animal system, a mouse in particular, that has no growth hormone or very, very low levels of growth hormone, they live much, much longer than animals with normal levels of growth hormone. And so we study that we can measure the circulating levels in the blood, and we can study processes that are involved in aging, in particular in metabolism.
And how does that translate to humans? You said it's a study in mice, and sometimes mm-hmm. you study other mammals as well. But is it, I mean, are you finding sort of similar results as you translate out that to humans?
Mm-hmm. So I haven't worked in humans, but I have collaborators and colleagues in the field that work do a lot of human work, and they have found in certain populations where the levels of this same hormone, because it's produced in humans too, the exact same hormone, that when the levels are much lower in these individuals, the downstream effects that it causes also increase health and lifespan in humans. So they've done a lot of genetic studies looking at mutations or variations in different genes and shown when this, the level of this hormone or its other effectors are lower, that these individuals tend to live longer also.
Is there a sort of a correlation between the people who have the differing levels? Like, for example, do you see high and low levels in either a male or a female, or someone who is Caucasian or not Caucasian? Or where do you see those differences?
That's a great question. So most of the work in humans so far has been found in females with a difference in genetics, that lower levels of growth hormone and one of its effectors called insulin-like growth factor, when the levels are lower, these particular women tend to live longer. But it works in men too. It's just not that there's not as much work that they've found on the positive end of that. But the other thing that you brought up was in terms of not sex differences or gender differences, but in levels of the growth hormone. So when you have extremely high levels of growth hormone, it causes individuals to live much, much shorter lives. So there are conditions in humans where a tumor will produce growth hormone in a condition called acromegaly. These individuals grow after puberty. They don't get taller, but they get some bone growth and other soft tissue growth, and they actually develop cardiac issues, diabetes, and they live much shorter lives. So we have the same correlate in mice. So we have mice that we work with that have very low levels to no growth hormone that live a long time, and animals that have very high levels of growth hormone that live half as long as they should.
So does that mean that, you know, outside of some things like real risky behavior, does that mean there's really nothing you can do to change how long or the quality of life that you're going to live?
Well, if you look outside of the hormone field and look at just what you do on an everyday, you know, basis, that moderation in your diet and some exercise is really positive always. So it's kind of what your grandmother told you to do, is eat your vegetables and fruits. Don't overeat, you know, overindulge in food and drink, and do some, you know, moderate exercise. And those individuals tend to have maintain a healthy life much longer than individuals that don't.
Yeah, because when it comes to aging, and humans, I think, in particular, have this sort of more is better approach to life. And when it comes to aging, is living longer the same thing as living better?
No, another good question. So it's if you think about the nursing home experience, is that many individuals in this current generation and the last generation are entering nursing homes at age 80, 85 or so, and they may live 5 to 10 to 15 years in a nursing home. So if your goal is 100, whereas what we're trying to promote in the field is a healthier quality of life. So not so much an increase in lifespan or longevity, but an increase in that health span. So it's better to spend the last 2 years of your life, perhaps, in a nursing home versus the last 20 years. So that's kind of the work that a lot of individuals, including myself and our laboratory, are working towards.
We are visiting with Dr. Holly Brown-Borg. She's recently been named a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and she is an expert on aging. And Dr. Brown-Borg, I would like to know some of the misconceptions about aging. You know, does everything have to hurt when you get older?
No, I think no. The answer is plainly, I think it's a matter of taking care of yourself. So your genetics will take you so far in terms of healthy aging and, you know, avoiding certain age-related diseases. But your environment also plays a role, and that's where the eating appropriately and, you know, getting lots of rest and exercising appropriately comes into play. So you can take care of your body the best you can in terms of the environment and what you do to it, but your genetics also plays a role. So if your family has a history of osteoarthritis or cardiovascular issues or diabetes, you can only do so much to avoid those things. But you can help yourself, you know, to live much healthier and longer and have a higher quality of life by impacting those environmental effects.
Is there a multidisciplinary approach to the science of aging? Because, yes, there is the genetic component, like you've mentioned, and then there is sort of our own health behavior if you're eating ice cream or if you're eating salads. But there are also things like your income level will impact your quality of life.
That's true. I mean, so I don't study this area. I've done reading in the area, and I know that there's some research showing that education level, a higher education level, and your income level it allows you to probably achieve your genetic potential and improve your environment more so than others with a lower income, perhaps, and a lower education level. But it doesn't, you know, the things that we can do mostly to impact our aging rate is nutrition. And, you know, just eating appropriately makes a huge difference in how your system utilizes the nutrients that come in, and the overindulgence can happen whether, you know, regardless of education and income level. So I think it's a moderation thing as a baseline, something to be thinking about that underlies your aging rate.
So when you talk about nutrition, what are you talking about? You're talking about a health food aisle and you only buy the superfoods? You've got the collagen and the acai berries, or are you just talking what,
balance.
More vegetables?
I think it's balance. I mean, lots of fruits and vegetables. I mean, I think there's a lot of research out now showing that plant-based diets are much healthier. We do need protein for sure. Eating fish and some red meat is okay, but it's the more plant-based foods you take in, your system utilizes that a bit differently than it does the protein levels that come from red meat and things. So it's not promoting a vegan or a vegetarian diet. It's just more moderation in red meat, perhaps. So we've studied ourselves in our laboratory something called a methionine-deficient diet. So methionine is an amino acid, one of the 20 amino acids that we have in our bodies, and then it's in food. And if you lower methionine levels, then you can extend health span and lifespan. It's been shown in numerous different mammalian systems and invertebrate systems. They've shown that lowering methionine impacts health in a positive way. And they're doing studies now in humans. So it boils down to fewer red meats, basically, and red meat's very high in methionine, as are nuts and a few other things. So I think bottom line is really a balance in your nutrition, not to overindulge in red meats. And this is, you know, the cattle associations and pork associations, poultry shouldn't get upset. My background is in is in agriculture, but it's just a moderation thing. So lots of fruits and vegetables, and a little less red meat perhaps is one of the positive things, and not a hard thing to do in terms of nutrition.
How about just the way that we live our lives right now? I mean, they've been saying sitting is the new smoking for about a decade now, so maybe there's something that's already the new sitting, and we have lots of screen time. How do these things impact our health spans?
You know, moderate amounts of exercise is what's being promoted, and I think that's good. It's just getting up, not sitting for more than a couple of hours maximum, getting up and running, you know, walking around your building, not running, but walking around your building, just movement in general, because after all that, you know, our muscles and systems are really meant for moving and not for sitting. And so I think it's in how we live our lives, not overindulgence in exercise or sedentary behavior. And I do believe the screen time impacts us tremendously, regardless of what nutrients we take in. But again, it's a moderation in just getting up and moving, doing simple things, you know, around the house and around your office, just to keep your muscles active and moving, your joints moving. Mm-hmm. And you should have less trouble when you get older.
Are there age-related conditions that you think we could do away with in, let's say, the next 50 years?
That's an interesting question. I think nutritionally, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes are probably greatly impacted by intake and types of intake. The activity issues, which I've mentioned with exercise and just moderate exercise and walking solely, impacts your muscles and how long they stay active and don't begin to atrophy. I'm not sure.
Okay.
that's a really good question. Yeah.
It's interesting to me in doing a little bit of research for this interview, the list of longest known living people. And so there's a category here for men, and their ages for the top 10 longest ever lifespans recorded for men are 113 to 116. For women, it's 116 to 122. And you did already mention that women and men have the differing levels of the growth hormone, which you see a direct correlation between lifespans there. Is that it, though? Like, is it really just... Well, I know we've talked about those other factors, but you just see women live longer than men so much more often.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors, I think, that play a role in that. And they haven't really determined any one smoking gun with that yet. We know that estrogen, which is produced in higher levels in women than men, does play a big role in terms of impacting cardiovascular disease, different types of dementias and things like that. So estrogen is very positive, plays a very positive role in terms of women kind of escaping some of the age-related diseases, or at least have lower levels. But I think traditionally it's also been stress levels have been different between men and women, and how women cope with stress versus how men cope with stress. So there's a variety of different things that are being looked at currently to determine, because we really don't know why exactly women live longer than men. I can tell you that the woman that did live the longest is Jean Clément. She was born and raised and lived her entire life in France. She smoked till she was like 118, and she drank her entire life, you know, good red French red wine. So that's genetics played a large role in her ability and to live longer. And, you know, she rode a bike until she was in her 100-teens at some point.
Yeah.
She was doing extremely well. So she's what we call an extreme outlier. But we also are seeing many, many more people make it to be 100. So the centenarian population in the U.S. and across the world has really increased over the years. And part of that has to do with hygiene has improved tremendously since the early 20th century. Hygiene vaccinations have saved us from many childhood diseases and some other diseases like influenza and things. So there's been a variety of things that have changed in the last 100 years that have improved us and probably have allowed us to reach more of our genetic potential than we would have previously.
There are a lot of critics on this sort of, well, not the science of aging, but critics on increasing lifespans who say, you know, overpopulation is a real problem. How do you respond to that criticism?
In terms of the science, I think the majority of us, probably 99% of us, are really more focused on increasing health and increasing the quality of life and not so much lifespan. Lifespan and longevity is a bonus. Hmm. If you're feeling good, you know, and contributing to the society, why not live longer? I think there's demographers that have shown that they believe that there is a limit to the longevity effect or the lifespan of humans. You know, I it goes both ways. I think it could impact the world's population, but it could also impact in more of a positive way that these individuals are still contributing in a great way to our communities and to education and the workforce and things like that. So 65, you know, as a retirement age, 65 to 70 seems quite young if we begin living, you know, very healthily until 90 and 100, so people could still be contributing to society. So there might be other ways to think about it. I guess I'm more of an optimist and not negative about those types of things.
What kind of funding is available for the type of research that you do?
So the primary source of funding is through the federal government, through the National Institutes of Health, and it's the National Institute on Aging. So they, like I said, provide the majority of funding. The National Science Foundation in the U.S. also provides funding for kind of mechanistic work with aging. They don't really support aging, but they support work that is integral to aging processes. And there's a foundation called the American Federation for Aging Research. It's called AFAR. They have been a huge supporter of junior level postdocs, postdoctoral associates, so immediately after a PhD. There's funding through this foundation and for early junior professors. They also provide funding specifically for aging.
Do you, either professionally or even just out of personal interest, keep track on aging and lifespan and health span differences across the globe? If you look at that list of the longest lived human beings, you see a lot from the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, and you see very few from basically any other country.
So I keep track, you know, somewhat. I think if you're looking at developed countries, so these are countries that have good vaccination programs, that have, you know, high quality of life in terms of hygiene and medical access to medical facilities, that type of thing, versus third world countries, which don't have access to the same things that we do. So that's where that quality of life comes into play. I think the other countries also don't necessarily have the record-keeping systems that we do. There's a group that keeps track of all the longest-lived individuals in the world, and they have multiple verification processes in order to validate people's claims of being very long-lived. And they use, you know, family Bibles and birth certificates and government records and that type of thing. And so a lot of these countries don't necessarily have those records, even though they claim to have, you know, someone that lives 100, that's 152 years old, that type of thing. So I think that's kind of the basis of those, the record keepers, and that it's showing that it's the Western world and the most developed countries that have the centenarian populations and those that live even longer.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Dr. Holly Brown-Borg is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Biomedical Sciences at UND and recently named a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Dr. Brown-Borg, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by financial associate Kyle Deberton with Thrivent Financial in Bismarck, helping members be wise with money and live generously. Details and information on how to reach Kyle can be found online at thrivent.com.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 7th, remembering Theodore Roosevelt. Introduced by his favorite tune, A Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. It's the first in a year-long series commemorating the centennial of T.R.'s death, a weekly entry about North Dakota's favorite adopted son. America and the world lost one of its most fascinating and productive citizens with the passing of Roosevelt on January 6, 1919. His health had become aggravated by rheumatic fever, mandating a month's stay in the hospital. He battled fever, vertigo, and anemia, and could no longer hear in his left ear. He had trouble with his balance and never regained sight in one eye from one of his bouts of presidential boxing. At 10 o'clock on the evening of January 11, 1919, T.R. informed his wife, Edith, that he felt as if he was dying. But the feeling passed. A few hours later, after spending some time writing, the 26th president retired to bed and requested his personal assistant to put out the light. Before morning sun had risen, he was gone. His son Archie, writing to his brothers, simply stated, "The old lion is dead." T.R. comments on death in one of his final books, The Great Adventure. Here's Steve Stark as Roosevelt.
Death is always, under all circumstances, a tragedy. For if it is not, then it means that life itself has become one. But it is well to live bravely and joyously and to face the inevitable end without flinching. Death is the one thing certain for the nation as well as for the man. Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die, and none are fit to die who have shrunk from both the joy and duty of life. Both life and death are part of the great adventure, and I say to you, accept it in such a spirit. I want you to face it and to be ready to do the best that lies within you to win out. Character, in the long run, is the decisive factor in the life of an individual. The only full life for men or women is led by those who, together, with hearts both gentle and valiant, face lives of love and duty.
Today's Dakota Daybook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Daybook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, as the state's new legislative session is in its first full week of duties, we revisit a conversation about what is good government and what is the role that journalists have in holding government officials accountable. That's coming up tomorrow on the show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.